Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and Caroline is not with us today, but for those of you who are frequent listeners, you know that she will be back. She's still doing fine. Our guest today is Regina Buttner, author of Absolution, a novel. Regina Buttner is a registered nurse turned writer from upstate New York. Absolution is her first novel. And you can learn more about her at reginabuttner.com. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Regina.
Thank you so much.
So you must be pretty excited to have published your first novel.
I am. It's an absolute thrill, and I still can hardly believe that it's really out there now. I've been waiting for this for so long, counting down the weeks and the days, and I'm finally here. It's wonderful.
And, of course, launching a book in the time of COVID is maybe a little bit different than normal, not so much on going into bookstores and doing readings. So what kind of things are you doing instead?
Well, I've done a number of radio interviews. I've written some guest blog posts and some essays that have appeared in various outlets, Women's Writers, Women's Books, and online social media has been a huge thing, especially Instagram, which I luckily really enjoy.
Oh, that's good.
And visuals. Yes, it's been a lot of fun. So I've done a lot of connecting with my fellow authors. I belong to a couple of debut author groups, and we've all supported each other wonderfully. And without social media, we couldn't have done this. But we've had Zoom calls and all kinds of wonderful things. Yeah.
What kind of things do you post on Instagram? To promote the book.
I try not to do a steady diet of book. I try to share personal things. So I have a mixture. I love the outdoors. I like hiking and paddling and gardening. So I do a lot of water pictures, from when I might take a paddle or a hike on the trails, flowers. And since I recently relocated to Southwest Florida from upstate New York, I'm just amazed at the beautiful flowers and trees and everything down here. It's all new to me. So I've been enjoying, photographs and the birds and, of course, my golden retriever, Juliet.
Aw. Now, Absolution is set in Pennsylvania and Georgia and Seattle and Boston area.
Yes.
Now, you're from upstate New York. You live in Southwest Florida now. Have you lived in some of these other places that you wrote about?
I have. I moved around quite a bit in my earlier years, so I'm familiar with all of those locales. And I brought, a little bit of my sensibility of those settings to each of the scenes that occurs in those places.
So I'm curious, why you chose to have your protagonist, whose name is Jeannie, and she's from a Catholic family in Pennsylvania. Why did you have her coming from Pennsylvania rather than upstate New York? Just curious.
Well, it is definitely a work of fiction, and so I wanted to somewhat distance myself from the story so people wouldn't think it was, something about me.
Okay, but people always are going to think that anyway. You know that, right?
Yes, I know. I think most authors tend, to draw from their own lives, their own experiences. But my daughter went to college in central Pennsylvania, and so I felt like the setting was similar to upstate New York in the rural, small town, a lot of the fields and the forests and all of that. So Pennsylvania, I thought, was a good fit to have Jeannie's fictional family be located.
Well, that's true. There is a lot of similarity. I grew up in southeast Pennsylvania myself, in Lancaster County.
Okay.
Yeah. And now I'm in Iowa. I split my time usually between Iowa and Texas, although I've been here in Iowa since April 25th. It's the first time I have been in one place for this long in at least 10 years, probably more. So,
oh my,
definitely a change of pace for me. So,
Yeah.
So, Regina, tell us what Absolution is about and what sparked this story for you.
Absolution is about a guilt-ridden young wife and mother who's struggling to keep a long-ago sexual assault and pregnancy a secret from her overly ambitious husband in the midst of the 1990s dot-com boom. And the story draws back the curtain of this seemingly perfect marriage to reveal a very dark and complex dynamic between the husband, who starts out as a nice guy, but then under the influence of, you know, the promise of riches and the dot-com boom, he turns into a manipulative narcissist. And it's this dynamic between him and his wife, who's desperate to make amends for what she perceives as the sins in her past. Jeannie thinks that the assault she suffered back in college at the hands of one of her professors, she thinks it's her fault somehow, that she was to blame. And so she's been carrying this guilt and denial and this deep sense of shame with her. So when she meets Greg, he's the first nice guy that she meets, you know, in the aftermath of what happened to her in college. And so she marries him kind of in a hurry because she thinks that devoting herself to marriage and motherhood the same way as her own mother did, that it will somehow absolve her for what she perceives as that sin in her past.
Now, the guilt, part of it stems from her upbringing. And I'm guessing that you must, even though you say this isn't about yourself, you must have some similarity in upbringing.
Well, yes. Yeah. and that's about as far as the similarity goes. I did indeed come from a traditional, what I call an old school Catholic family. We, you know, went to Sunday Mass. We took all the sacraments, went through Catholic school from grades 1 through 12. And, you know, my family was very observant. And so I was brought up in sort of a strict household. And I have that reflected in Jeannie's upbringing. So she is a little bit unworldly. She is a little bit naive, and she is trying very hard to be a good girl.
What made you want to write about this kind of being torn between being good and the realities of modern life?
Well, I've always been fascinated by the concept of one's family of origin and how the families we grow up in teach us our values. They teach us ways of communicating, ways of showing emotion, and ways of showing affection. And that family of origin has far-reaching effects on us as adults in our own romantic and marital relationships, because we're carrying with us what we learned as children. And so I thought it would be an interesting story to delve into someone like Jeannie, who comes from this, you know, rather strict and restricted background and is faced with this terribly worldly trauma and doesn't know how to process it or how to respond to it. And so her response is denial and shame.
And I think that was probably true of a lot of young women in her situation in that time period, because it would have happened in the 90s. And
Yes.
Now, do you think it's different today? Have things changed?
I certainly hope so. Yes, yeah. I do believe it has changed quite a bit. I went to college, you know, I graduated in the late 1980s, and I know that it's different. It's very different from how my daughter has grown up and what she experienced in college. And thank heaven for it. It's a good thing. It's progress. And I would hope, you know, a takeaway for my readers, especially women, would be to hear the message that your past does not define you. No matter what happened to you, where you came from, what your background is, we all are free to make choices and take actions that can redefine our path in life. And that's what Jeannie does. She forges her own path. She recovers from this trauma, and she takes back her power.
Now, the of course, the Me Too movement has probably assisted women, some women, with owning that, you know, being able to say, okay, this happened to me, but that's not me. And why do you think, though, that somebody, I mean, it was obvious that she knew that she didn't want to have sex with this man who was in a position of power over her. What made her feel so guilty?
She felt guilty for a number of reasons. First of all, she feels stupid because she was taken in by him. He fed her, you know, a few lines that you'll hear in my reading. She feels like she exercised poor judgment. She shouldn't have gone to his house with him when she knew his wife wasn't there. She should have left sooner. She shouldn't have drank the wine. She shouldn't have let any of this happen. And it's her fault for being there. And she's afraid of the consequences. She knows he's a man in a position of power. And if she accuses him, it's his word against hers. And she feels no one will believe her.
Do you want to go ahead and read, Regina, so our listeners can really get a feel for the book?
Sure. All right. So this opening scene is taking place very near the campus of Jeannie's College in Pennsylvania, 1993. I was in bed, but it wasn't my bed. I struggled to surface from the depths of my drunken haze. I was freezing. My eyes cracked open and focused on an air conditioning unit whirring in the window. This wasn't my room. I was curled into a tight fetal position with my goose-pimpled arms clamped to my chest and, oh my God, was I naked? I ran a hand over my stomach and down to my hips. Nothing. The air blasting from the AC smelled of mildew, and the pillow under my head held the taint of cigarettes. I pushed myself up onto my elbows. Beside me, my early American literature professor stirred and coughed, then rolled away from me, dead asleep. I remembered going to Dr. Asner's office the afternoon before, prepared to beg him for an extension on my final paper. I'd been sick with mono for weeks, and I was behind in all my classes. Graduation was only a month away. "I'm sorry you've been ill, Jeannie," he'd said. He had that upscale outdoorsy sort of look in his rag wool sweater, pressed jeans, and spotless L.L. Bean boots. "I wish you would have come to me sooner. I was going to recommend you for a scholarship to the graduate program, but now that you're in danger of failing, I'm not sure I can help you." I tried not to cry. My financial aid had run out. My part-time job with dining services wouldn't cover the cost in an additional semester, and my parents couldn't afford it. Asner scooched his chair closer to mine and put a comforting hand on my knee. "We can talk it over," he said, "someplace more comfortable." I can't believe I fell for such an obvious line. We walked across the quad together, the spring air heavy with the fishy stink of hawthorns in full bloom. It was late Friday afternoon and the campus was deserted. I had to hustle to keep up with Asner's athletic pace. I was still weak from the lingering effects of the mono, and I fatigued easily. "How about a drink?" he said. Of course I agreed. I wasn't about to say no to the newly installed chair of the English department. We headed towards State Street, and for a delighted minute, I thought he was going to take me to the frou-frou wine bar where the faculty liked to hang out. But then he turned left onto Fairview Avenue and pointed out his big brick house on the next corner. I glanced at his left hand, saw the gold wedding band. So I'd get to meet his wife. She was probably in the kitchen, fixing his supper right now, expecting him back from office hours at any minute. But no one was home except a sleek wisp of a cat that leaped from the windowsill and scraped itself against my legs. I preferred dogs to cats and nudged it away with my toe. Dr. Asner went over to a tall wooden wine rack in a corner of the living room. "Red or white?" he asked. "Red," I said, thinking it the more cultured choice. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really a drinker. I perched myself on the edge of the couch as he poured two glasses and handed one to me. The only kind of red wine I knew was that awful cheap stuff that came in a jug, so I was surprised by how good it tasted. Asner dropped into the leather armchair across from me and propped his ankle on his knee. He was handsomer than I'd ever noticed before, and younger, too. I wondered where his wife was. I fiddled with my backpack at my feet. Dr. Asner, about my final paper? Don't worry about the paper, Jeannie. You can have till the end of exam week to turn it in. Thank you. I gulped my wine in relief and glanced through the archway toward the dark kitchen. I suppose your wife will be getting home soon? I don't want to take up your time. No worries, he said. She's away at a conference. Poetry Society of America. I remembered now. His wife taught freshman English. She went by her maiden name, so I hadn't connected the two of them right off. Asner reached for my glass, refilled it, and passed it back to me. I'd eaten nothing but a granola bar all day, and I was already catching a buzz. I felt funny being alone with him now, knowing his wife wasn't around. I thought I should probably leave pretty soon, but I was afraid of seeming rude if I skipped out too quickly. I'd at least finished my wine. Asner got up and put on the new Sting CD that I totally loved. The edges of the room started to grow hazy. The skinny cat jumped into my lap, and I laughed and stroked its narrow back. Asner was on the couch with me now, pouring us more wine. I'm not exactly sure how the kissing started, but I know I didn't resist it at first. I was flattered and amazed that such an accomplished older man could possibly be attracted to me. I didn't have much of a love life. Boys seemed to overlook me for some reason. They always went for my roommate Carla, who was much prettier and far more outgoing than I was. So when Asner took me by the hands, tugged me up from the couch and headed for the stairs, I was thrilled to follow right behind him, caught up in a strong current of wonder and desire. But when he steered me into his bedroom and pushed me backward onto his bed, it was as if I woke up all of a sudden and realized what I was doing. No, I said, pulling away from him. No, you're married. Never mind my wife. She's my problem, not yours. He'd kissed me again, hard. I had tried to push him off me, but he wouldn't let go of my arms. I remembered kicking and thrashing, my long hair tangled in my face, my head jammed into the pillows. I hadn't had the strength to fight. I'd felt the weight of his body on top of mine pinning me down. After that, it was all blank.
And that was Regina Butner reading from Absolution. When you wrote this book, did you write from beginning to end, like chronologically? Did you start with that scene?
No, not at all. my original draft was far different from this final book that you have now. It started out, I had no idea how to go about writing a novel. I was a complete novice. And I started by compiling a list of potential scenes in the book. And each day that I sat down to write, I would simply pick a scene, one that resonated with me that day, and I would start writing. And after I'd exhausted that scene list, I compiled these scenes into what seemed like a logical chronological order, and that was my first draft. But I soon realized there wasn't enough of a plot there. There was no story arc. And so I had to figure out, you know, it was essentially about a marriage going bad, but I had to come up with a very compelling reason why Jeannie would stay with this marriage for so long. And that was when I hit upon the idea that she is harboring this deep secret, and she feels that the consequences of the secret coming to light would be far worse than putting up with the daily miseries of her life with this husband, Greg.
Right. Plus, there was also the whole idea of staying together for the kids.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And because by the time things got really bad, they had two kids.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a valid reason too, if you, but he wasn't paying any attention to the kids either. So there wasn't a whole lot of benefit there.
No, it was really a dysfunctional marriage. But you have to keep in mind, Jeannie was raised all her life. She was trained really to become a wife and mother. Her mother, her own mother, was sort of a 1950s style housewife. And a woman with a daughter with a career and a family just didn't compute with her mother. So Jeannie does feel this very strong pull to stay in the marriage and keep her family together.
Plus, she had older sisters that were following that same path, too. She didn't really have any role models other than her friend, her college roommate, chose a different path. Yeah.
Her three sisters were what I call the holy trinity of careers for women of her mother's generation. They were essentially a nurse, a secretary, and a teacher. And so, you know, Jeannie sort of broke out of that mold by going to college to begin with. But she's, you know, got a hard path to travel because she, as you said, does not have role models. No.
Yeah. And yeah, I remember when that was the options, teacher, secretary, or nurse. And if you didn't want to be any of those, what did you do?
Right.
In fact, I have a friend from high school. We moved from Pennsylvania to Iowa when I was starting ninth grade. And years later, I was visiting back in the area where I grew up and connected with someone who'd been a very close friend in junior high who had been a secretary. And she, as, you know, probably in her 40s, went to college and ended up getting a master's degree and, you know, found what she truly loved to do. But she was telling me that the reason she became a secretary, she went to secretarial school and became a secretary because that's all the guidance counselors, they gave her those options, teacher, secretary, nurse. She didn't want to be a teacher. She didn't want to be a nurse. So that was it.
Yes. It is hard to believe now, you know, in the year 2020, that's how it was. But I have older sisters myself, and that was what their guidance counselors told them.
And one of the worst things about that is that you ended up with teachers who really didn't want to teach. They didn't want to be teachers.
Yeah.
They just didn't want to be nurses or secretaries more.
And, you know, I think you're right.
Yeah. And now, if you go into if you become a teacher now, it's because that's what you really want to do. And I think that's a good thing.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. You have to have the passion. Yeah.
So I'm really interested in your, you know, how this book came together. So it sounds like this was the first novel that you attempted.
Yes, it was.
And that's kind of uncommon for you, for people to actually publish their first novel that they wrote. Had you always wanted to be a writer? Was this something you dreamed about for a long time?
Oh, most definitely. As a kid, I was a huge reader, always going to the library and bringing home a stack of books. And I wanted to be an author. I wanted to write horse books, like Misty of Chincoteague. And it was something in the back of my mind all the way through my adulthood, but I never really had the time to sit down and focus on it because I was so busy raising my children, you know, and I did become a single parent eventually. And, you know, that's a busy, busy job. So it wasn't until 6 years ago that I finally said, okay, it's time. And I took my first writing class.
And where did you go for that? Did you go to a college program or?
Well, in my former town of Rochester, New York, there is a literary center that offers classes and workshops. And so that was where I started out. And each class led to a more advanced class. And eventually I was invited to join a critique group and I started attending conferences. So it just took off from there.
That's very cool way to get started. So you had the support and I really like the fact that that type of situation is available for people. Were there any conferences that you went to that you would really recommend that made a real difference for you?
I think the biggest influence on me was the Writer's Digest conference in New York City. It is a big conference, and it was my first one that I attended. And I was amazed at how instantly I was able to bond with my fellow writers, even though writers, you know, maybe it's a stereotype, but we kind of tend to be introverts because writing is a solitary endeavor, but I would walk into a session and sit down, and the people to the left and to the right, in front of me, behind me, everyone would just turn around and say, "Oh, hello, where are you from?" And, you know, you'd have a name tag with your genre posted on it, and we would just start talking. You know, how's your work in progress going? What do you write? And it just opened my eyes to this whole new world.
So what genre did you have on your name tag at that point?
It was women's fiction. Okay. And Absolution is a work of women's fiction, and it could more specifically be described as a domestic drama.
Or an anti-romance.
Yeah, you could call it that too.
You're listening to Writer's Voices. I'm Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Regina Butner, author of Absolution. Now, the book is written in first person. Was that something that you thought about, or it just came very naturally?
I did think about it quite a bit. I believe I might have started in first person, switched to third person, because I didn't want it to be so memoirish. I didn't want it to be a story about me. And then I ended up switching back to first person because I really wanted to have the reader inside Jeannie's head and to travel her journey with her.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. Is some people find writing in first person the easiest. Do you think that's true for you?
Yeah, I do think so. It's natural. I'm a storyteller. I tell stories to my friends all the time, and that's, of course, first person. So it does come naturally.
Right. Now, when you wrote this scene list, did you know that it was a story about a marriage falling apart, and did you know how it would end?
That was the trouble. I didn't have a solid ending. There was no climax. There was no denouement. It sort of petered out. And so that was when, you know, I realized I've got to fix this story arc and something else needs to happen here.
So you found something fairly dramatic, which is in some ways that the beginning is where the most action of the book takes place. Everything else is pretty interior in a way. There's not a lot of not a lot of things actually happening.
Yes, and that is a hallmark of women's fiction. It's about the main character's emotional journey. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this isn't a thriller. It's not a crime drama or mystery. It's all about Jeannie's emotional journey, Jeannie's change, and her eventual empowerment.
Now, what do you see Jeannie doing after this book?
I would hope that she would return to school, finish that college degree, maybe even get an advanced degree, and pursue her career. She was interested. She was an English major. She worked in a library at one point, and maybe she followed that path. I would hope she truly made a success of herself as a career woman and as a mother. And as an added benefit, I hope she found love in the end.
Now, when you were writing this, so how long did you actually spend writing the book?
It did take me 5 years.
Five years. So you were spending a lot of time with Jeannie.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did you miss her when you were done?
Not exactly. And I have heard other authors say that, how they miss their characters and they're not ready to let them go. But I think because Jeannie transforms herself so dramatically and she leaves behind, you know, such awful circumstances, I was happy to see her off into the world and wish her well.
Were there times when, as you're writing, that you'd write something and then you think, you know what, she wouldn't actually do that?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. And that was something I learned in a workshop. They say, they talk about putting yourself into your character's shoes and walking around in them for a few days even. And as you're going about your regular daily tasks and your responsibilities, you think of yourself as Jeannie. What would Jeannie do? What would she say? How would she react? And it's a really insightful exercise. It helps you really see through that character's eyes.
Now, one of the the issues is interfaith marriage. Jeannie was, of course, raised Catholic. Greg was not. But the religious difference didn't really come up that much between them. And it could have. So why did you make that choice to not have that really be a point of contention between them?
Basically because Greg's family is not religious. And so to him, it doesn't matter. He doesn't feel the need to have, you know, the marriage blessed by God the way that Jeannie does. It does, however, come up with his mother, Florence, the evil mother-in-law. She's, you know, she's a well-to-do Southern woman. She's kind of snooty. And she does at one point insult Jeannie for being Catholic and, you know, makes some crack about her time for you to catch up with those sisters of yours and, you know, have a whole lot more babies. That's what you Catholics do, isn't it? And Greg doesn't really defend her. He doesn't stand up to his mother and say, Mom, you know, enough. And so it's more of a subtle conflict between them where Greg just doesn't get it. And it's not always, you know, entirely his fault. It's just the way he was raised.
Well, there is that, you know, there are moments throughout the book where you almost paint Greg in a sympathetic light, you know, that it isn't really his fault. It's just his mother's so terrible. How do you feel about blaming the mom?
Well, mothers-in-law can be convenient scapegoats for everybody. She was a fun character to create. She was fun. And I was able to offload some of the blame that could have been heaped on Greg and offload it onto Florence. And I did want Greg to be somewhat sympathetic because I was pulling in that concept of the family origin right there. He was raised a certain way and he didn't know any other way of being, you know, and he was raised under his mother's thumb. She was quite controlling and narcissistic in her own way. So he was battling his own sort of demons from his past. And then Jeannie has hers. And they have these hidden agendas that eventually collide and things don't turn out well.
Now, part of the, quite a bit of it is set in the dot-com era of Seattle in the 1990s. And did you have experience with that era?
Yes, I actually was living with my husband in Seattle during that time. And I was well familiar with the excitement and the hype and almost the mania, these IPOs, these initial public offerings of these internet startups, you know, being offered on the stock market, and people were going crazy. People who worked for the dot-coms were being issued stock options that they could then flip and cash in, and they'd be instant millionaires on paper, at least. And people were spending money sometimes that they didn't really even have yet. And the housing boom was huge and people were living large, you know? And so I pulled a lot of that right into this story.
Yeah, I could tell it seemed quite realistic, that aspect of it, and that you knew what you were talking about. Now, and Greg was caught up in that. He was working for an internet startup. He was on an upward path. He was really counting heavily on that IPO. I almost expected him to get badly hurt by the crash, and you kind of let him off easy.
Well, if Greg's not something, he's smart. He's savvy. And so he didn't overexpose himself. Yeah. So, yeah, I didn't want it to be a story about, you know, a financial disaster. I wanted it to stay rooted in the marriage, the marital relationship.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was why.
Now, you mentioned that you became a single mom. So how do you view marriage? I know that's a kind of big question. But
I was just going to say that's broad. Yes. I'm not jaded. I'm not bitter the way perhaps some women might be. I still think marriage is a wonderful institution, and maybe that sounds like something my mother would say, but I mean it. My parents' marriage was an excellent example for me. It was loving and cooperative and long lasting. And
now you know what Mae West
it, sometimes.
Now you know what Mae West said about marriage, right?
What was that?
Marriage is a fine institution, but I'm not ready for an institution.
yes, I recall that now. Right. Yeah. I know a lot of friends who are in wonderfully strong marriages and a lot who tried it and failed. And, you know, it's kind of 50-50, unfortunately. So I am thankful that divorce isn't stigmatized the way it was more so when I was a kid or even from my mother's generation. It's just life. Sometimes things don't work out. You make a poor choice, you make the wrong choice, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get back to your writing process, and which I found really fascinating the way this started out. Would you do your next book differently, or are you doing your next book differently?
Oh, yes. yes. I felt with Absolution, I was learning how to write as I went along. I literally was. And my current work in progress, I have approached it quite differently. And for one thing, it's a much lighter story. It's more fun to write. And I have written an outline because I am a plotter rather than a pantser. Pantsers are those who write by the seat of their pants. And I like to have that roadmap every day. I want to know where I'm going. So I have a running outline of every scene, all those, the dramatic dominoes, this causes this and the consequence is that. And I am working my way through it. And it feels much better to me, actually, to be more organized this way.
But you do, and so you do write from beginning to end. Now.
It depends, you know. Yeah, now I'm writing chronologically, but I may end up rearranging things. For example, in Absolution, I had the book originally starting with Jeannie and Greg getting engaged.
Mm.
You know, the beginning of the relationship, basically. And I said, you know, that's just too linear. I want to maybe, you know, have a flashback here and there and that sort of thing. So it depends upon the story, and the story sort of speaks to you and tells you where it needs to go. It's funny, but the story takes on a life of its own.
It sure does. Now, Absolution is basically chronological and single point of view, single perspective. First person, and that is, it's easy to follow. A lot of the fiction that we get, which is, you know, great fiction, I'm not saying it's not, but it can be hard to follow sometimes because of multiple points of view and multiple timelines sometimes, and is this happening now, is this the past, and it can be a little tricky. Are you drawn to putting that kind of complexity in, or do you like to keep it a little more straightforward?
I tend to lean more towards the straightforward. And with Jeannie's story, she is kind of a simple, straightforward person. And so I thought the story structure suited her.
Mm-hmm.
With my work in progress, I'm not sure where it's going to take me. I don't know yet. I'm writing it in a chronological manner, but that may all change. This is only draft one. So draft one is, you know, just the basic, I liken it to building a house. I'm framing it, framing the story. So we'll see where it goes.
Do you write on computer or on paper?
Oh, on the computer.
On the computer.
I can't imagine writing longhand.
And do you have any special tools that you use to keep things organized?
I use a poster board and note cards. I'm very visual, which kind of relates to my love of Instagram. I love visuals. So I need to see where I'm going. So posting my scene cards up on a board in my writing space is a huge help to me. So I can jump from one point to the other, you know, just with my eyes, I can see where this story is going.
Wow. The characters, are there sometimes where a character like appears that you didn't know was going to be in the story?
You know, that does sometimes happen. In Jeannie's case, I realized she already had her best friend, Carla, but Carla's not there. They live on opposite sides of the country. So I did have to invent some people along the way because she is isolated from her family and friends. She and her husband move around when he's jumping between jobs, so she doesn't have roots. But she needed allies. There needed to be people who were there to help her along the way, because life doesn't happen in a vacuum. Even if you are isolated, you are still part of a community. So yes, people, characters did sort of reveal themselves to me as I went along.
Right. And were there any that you think, oh, there might be another story behind this guy or this girl?
Yes. Well, at one point, when Jeannie and Greg are living in the suburbs of Seattle, Jeannie is the stay-at-home mom, and she joins a play group that she takes her two very young children to in the neighborhood. And there's a single dad, there's a stay-at-home dad there, and he's the only dad in the group because his wife is the breadwinner. And she strikes up a friendship with him, and there's a little bit of a hint of attraction between them. And so that could have been a story in itself.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't, you know, the space for it within Absolution. But yes, that was an intriguing sideline.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Regina Butner, author of Absolution. Regina, why did you choose that title?
It was not my original title. It evolved with the help of my publisher. I originally called the book Offer It Up, which was a very...
I know what that means.
Okay, yes, a very Catholic concept.
A very Catholic concept, yep.
Yes, you know, offering up your sufferings to help ease, theoretically, not theoretically, I guess spiritually easing the sufferings of Jesus. And my mother would say, offer it up, offer it up.
Yeah.
And my publisher was afraid that sounded too much like a self-help book.
Although I think Catholics would know. But I got to say, at some point I came to have a theological issue with that whole concept.
Did you?
I did, yeah. Because it is, it's like, and it's a little hard to explain exactly what I mean, but it's like, okay, so my suffering is going to ease the suffering of Jesus. That's like really giving me way too much credit. You know, it's like really egocentric in a way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the nuns taught it to us in grammar school. And I think as, you know, little kids in whatever, the third grade, we saw it as a collective effort almost, like, okay, if we're all good, then we're all going to be helping Jesus, kind of thing like that. So, but that's an interesting way to think about it.
You know, there were a lot of things that I just accepted as a young Catholic child that later when I looked at it, I'm like, you know, that's actually pretty not right. But you know, I not to, you know, there's plenty of people who still accept it and believe it and live in that faith, and that's absolutely fine. I respect that, but it just didn't feel, or intellectually, it was, I couldn't grasp those concepts. I felt they were too, like I said, egocentric. So
I understand what you're saying. Yes. And part of my purpose in writing this particular story was to sort of open the door onto this world, because the world is changing rapidly. It changes with every generation. And, you know, my daughter growing up, she's in her early 20s. She went to Catholic school too, but she wasn't raised the same way as I was in regard to her faith, nor was I raised the same way my mother was. So I did want to kind of explore that and look into that old school Catholic sensibility and how it affects, you know, the long range of your adult life.
And it did have a big impact on mine. I don't want to get into that level of personal detail, but I had I had some guilt that impacted, that affected my life for many, many years, that now I realize was unhealthy. And I made decisions for the wrong reasons, and not always good decisions, based on that. So I did identify with Jeannie in that way.
Well, I'm glad you did. Yeah.
Yeah. And it made me look at the whole, you know, we have this kind of stereotype of Catholic guilt in, you know, they make jokes about it.
Oh, yes, yeah. A lot of jokes. I know it.
So but there's usually some truth behind that type of stereotype.
Yes, it was real for me growing up. It truly was. So, I imagine many, many women, you know, in my age range who grew up in the Catholic parochial school system could relate to that. Yes.
Yep. I think I agree. I think so. So, let's talk a little bit, Regina. I almost called you Jeannie, which I guess could be a nickname for Regina.
But... No, I was Gina. It was G.
Anyway, let's talk a little bit about how you published the book. So, what was your path to publication?
My path. It was a long and winding path. I did start out querying the traditional route, querying agents, trying to go through a traditional publisher. And I worked at that for about a year, which is not unusual to be sending your query letters out for that long. And then I attended a conference in Boston called Muse in the Marketplace, and a presenter there was talking about hybrid publishers, which is a new trend. Hybrid is kind of a combo between traditional publishing and self-publishing, where both the author and the publisher have a stake in bringing this book to publication. And so I heard about She Writes Press, which is, I think, the premier hybrid publisher in the country. They're well-regarded, well-respected, award-winning, and I said, this sounds like the place for me. And She Writes Press, you can guess by the name, they publish
women's fiction.
Female authors. Yeah, right on. And a lot of memoirs as well.
Yeah.
And I looked through their catalog, I read their author bios, and I said, I would just love to find a home here. So I submitted directly to them, and lo and behold, they accepted my manuscript.
Now, did they work with you on editing?
Yes, they are very collaborative. The fortunate thing with them being a smaller publishing house is that they are able to give their authors more personal attention, which I have heard the larger Big Five publishers in New York City maybe aren't able to do that. And so they collaborated with me on the cover design. I was able to give my input, my feedback. I absolutely love the final cover. And we achieved that with a suggestion from me, so they changed it, and they're so responsive. It's just been a wonderful experience working with them.
Wow. And how long did the process take from when they accepted it to when it actually came out?
Approximately 18 months.
Okay, so that's pretty typical for publishing.
Yeah.
Did you have deadlines along the way that you had to meet?
Yes, indeed. They sent me, my editorial manager sent me a calendar with all the deadlines, you know, for proofreading, turning in first pages, second pages, and so forth, when the cover would be approved, that sort of thing. So I had to adhere to deadlines, but it was never under pressure. I guess I'm a prompt responder anyway, you know, but they gave me plenty of advance notice, so nothing was ever under the gun.
And were you still working as a nurse during this time too?
Yes, but I was fortunate working in home health care, so I had quite a flexible schedule, and I was able, you know, to work my writing time around that. It worked out very well.
Do you write every day?
When I was in the thick of writing Absolution, yes, almost every day. Currently, I've taken a little break. I was moving, relocating from New York to Florida. Huge, huge change.
Why'd you do
climate.
That?
My children are grown. They're out of the house now. They're living on their own. They're established in their own jobs and their own places. And it was time for me to move on. And to be honest, I was ready to trade in the cold and gray winter of upstate New York.
I got out of Dodge just in time, probably.
I've got tropical sun and tropical flowers now.
Wow. So when you said you were writing every day, did you have a certain time of day that you prefer to write?
I liked to get started in the morning. If it was a designated writing day, I looked forward to it. I would wake up and go, today's a writing day. I love this. I loved it. I would immerse myself. And sometimes I would write 9 or 10 hours a day when I was editing. Editing is quite different from actually producing, you know, fresh words on the page. But I could really power through my pages and get it done. And such a satisfying feeling.
Would you ever want to, like, write full time?
Oh, it's my dream. Yeah. Maybe one day. We'll see. It takes time for an author to establish their brand, to establish a name for themselves. And I've only got this one book that just came out this week. So,
well, congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you.
Do you have, like, other books other than the one you're working on now, sort of like, next I want to write about this and then I want to write about that? Or does it come one at a time?
I kind of do. I have a list. I haven't made up my mind what book number 3 will be yet, and I think that will sort of be revealed to me as time goes on. So I don't want to be too rigid, you know. I do want to just be open to new ideas and where those take me.
What other kinds of writing do you like to do?
I have very much enjoyed writing short stories, and for a time I wrote flash fiction. I took a course, and flash fiction is sort of like short story. I'd say under 1,000 words is flash fiction. And that was really a lot of fun because I could latch on to something sort of like a vignette, and it was a challenge to pack in as much as I could in a very small word count. So that was a lot of fun.
Mm. And other types of novels, like, so are you going to focus on this type of women's fiction, or branch out into anything else?
I would like to branch out, really. Women's fiction is wonderful. I feel an affinity for it, but I don't want to limit myself. So my next book that I'm working on is it's still kind of a domestic drama, but it's a love triangle with some supernatural elements. So there's a medium involved and tarot cards and readings and things like that. And it's more fun. It's not locked into marriage and family. It's more about, oh, these three people, it's two women and a man, and they're each vying for someone else's attention, and there's a lot of subterfuge and rivalry and some revenge that comes out in the end. So, yeah.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Yes, it's been fun to work on.
I bet, I bet. Well, Regina, do you have any words of advice for wannabe authors?
Yes, my main piece of advice is that the best thing you can do for yourself is to develop a disciplined writing habit. Discipline is what gets you through, and I've heard it referred to as butt in chair. If your
Yeah.
butt isn't in the chair, you're probably not writing, because most of us don't write standing up. So you need to show up every day, get in the chair, sit down, and you get to work. And sometimes it's really hard, but a little trick I've learned is that it doesn't matter what that first sentence is, as long as you simply start writing. So your first sentence can be a throwaway. Don't labor over it. Don't write and rewrite and edit and revise. Just keep going.
Well, that
And
is
that's what,
very good
yeah.
advice. Very good advice. Thank you, Regina. And
Well, you're welcome.
that's our time for today. I did find a quote about absolution that I think is kind of fitting for this. It's from Oscar Wilde. There is a luxury in self-reproach. When we blame ourselves, we feel no one else has a right to blame us.
Ah, yes. That says it right there.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Monica. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
My pleasure. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.